For argument today is United States against LaShore. Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Sullivan. I'm a senior law student licensed under Rule 711. I represent the defendant appellant in this case, James L. LaShore. We object to the admission in the court below of two pieces of evidence, a bait money list and my client's post-arrest interrogation statement. I'd like to start with the bait money list. Now, the list was admitted under the business records exception to the hearsay rule, which is a specific carve-out. And in order to get the benefit of that exception, one has to meet its requirements. The most important requirement the government failed to establish in this case was the so-called two regularities requirement. That is to say that the record has to be something that it is the regular practice of the business to make in the course of a regularly conducted business activity. And the activity, the record in question in this case, of course, is the list itself. The activity in question is the recordation of banknote serial numbers.
And why isn't it good enough to verify periodically, as the testimony indicated was done, that this was a good bait money list? I mean, it sounds like your position is that banks have to throw away their list every 4 months and create a new list rather than sitting there and making sure that the serial numbers on the list they have are still accurate.
Right. Well, I think that there are two reasons why checking is not sufficient. One is simply that the language of the rule specifically says it must be something, a record that it is the regular practice of the business to make.
But I'm trying to understand what that means. And if you pull out your bait money list and you pull out the bait money and you make sure that the numbers all match up, why isn't that, quote, making the list, as opposed to tossing out into the wastebasket or through the shredder your old list and just writing it all down again?
Well, there's a distinct difference, Your Honor, between checking or verifying a list and actually producing a list. To check a list is a practice that admits of mistakes. It can be cursory. It can be haphazard, whereas to actually have to produce something can require more thoroughness, more attention to detail. And so the language of the rule, make, which suggests produce, not check, has a real gain in terms of the reliability of the evidence in question. Now, the court below did not discuss this requirement, the two regularities requirement, and that is a misinterpretation of the law that is reviewable by this court. Tenovo. And so our core contention with respect to the bait money list is that there has to be a facing up to this requirement, that there be two regularities. Now, we also object to my client's post-arrest interrogation statement on two
grounds.
But
he didn't make any inculpatory statements at that time, did he? I thought your primary problem was the fact that just showing him in an interrogation context on this DVD was so prejudicial and for such little gain that it shouldn't have been, the DVD shouldn't have been used.
That is one of our arguments, Your Honor, yes. We also argue that even though he didn't confess to any crime on the DVD, that it was still, since it was still used against him at trial.
How?
Well, it was shown to, we believe, one, it was shown improperly to suggest that he was guilty on an emotional ground. And
but that's the 403 argument. What, in addition to the 403 argument, do you have?
Well, the attorney for the prosecution below, Your Honor, argued that my client had made certain inconsistent statements. Now, we don't think that that's the case on a viewing of the DVD. But
that would be an acceptable use of the DVD, right, to show inconsistent statements?
It would be, Your Honor, yes. The inconsistency to which the government refers is a strange one because it is primarily an inconsistency in the phrasing of a question that the interrogator asked. He asked first, you walked from your house to the drug house on Cass Street. Did you walk? And he says yes. And then later on he says, well, did you run? And he says yes. So it's and that's it. And that's fairly insignificant as an inconsistency, Your Honor. And with respect to this argument, the 403 argument, we recognize that this is a fairly unique case. This is a case in which there is relatively low
Fairly unique?
Very unique?
Partially unique?
A unique case, Your Honor. And it is unique because this is a case in which there is weak identification evidence presented by the government. The DVD itself provides very little probative value itself as such. And it's the unfair prejudice that it imports into the process.
The government suggests a number of things that one could glean from watching the DVD that it says are legitimate, including the fact that, I guess, Mr. LaShore is left-handed, including the fact that it shows that he is, in fact, in command of his facilities as he's talking to the officers. He admits, I think, that it's his that Jeannie Colon or whatever is his girlfriend, his fiance, right?
Right.
So these are all, I mean, they're little bits and pieces, but the government, in a circumstantial case especially, builds its case that way.
Certainly, Your Honor. These are, however, bits and pieces that largely came out by alternative means, primarily by the testimony of Special Agent Lorne, who is Mr. LaShore's interrogator, but also by the testimony of other officers who dealt with Mr. LaShore at the police station. And so that is our argument trains on exactly what is the unique contribution of the DVD to the government's case that it didn't get from other sources.
If this were not, you're conceding this is plain error review, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the worst you can say about this DVD is that it's cumulative evidence, why is that something that we should regard as plain error?
Because it isn't just that it repeats evidence brought in from other sources, Your Honor. It's that it imports an emotional ground for the jury on which to base its conviction, and that is a defendant is presented in a situation of custodial interrogation, and it's sort of the modern equivalent of bringing the defendant in shackles and chains.
Counsel, don't let me interrupt you. Let me finish answering Judge Wood, but I've got a related question. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it's the unfair prejudice that it brings and not the cumulative nature of the evidence.
Right. Counsel, let me ask you the question that troubles me about this plain error argument. You're making an argument under Rule 403 that whatever probative force there was in corroborating detail and telling the story and so on is outweighed by prejudice. Can a Rule 403 claim ever be plain error? Because the whole function of Rule 403 is to authorize the district court in its discretion to exclude probative evidence that is otherwise probative. How does one say on appeal that a district court committed plain error on a discretionary ruling when the court was never asked to exercise discretion?
Well, Your Honor, I think that insofar as the district court has a role as the gatekeeper of the evidence that is admitted into the trial. If there is a unique case as this is, where the evidence proffered.
Look, this is not a question about this case. This is a question about normal rules of law. Normally, I, in any event, think of plain error as the district court committed some legal mistake. Unfortunately, counsel forgot to point that out to him, and now here we are. But Rule 403 balancing is not a legal mistake one way or the other. Rule 403 gives a lawyer a right to appeal to a certain kind of discretionary ruling. The question I'm asking is one of law. Can there be plain error when the district court is never asked to exercise discretion?
Yes, I believe there can, Your Honor, because I would draw a parallel between this case and other discretionary rulings that a district court is asked to make. One can argue on appeal that the admission of any piece of evidence was, even if one does not preserve that issue, that it was plain error for the district court to admit it. Look,
if one side offers hearsay evidence, it would be legal error for the district court to let it in over objection. No discretion the district court had to exercise. It's either hearsay or it isn't. It's covered by one of the exceptions or it isn't. I'm worried about the case where there's nothing but discretion. Are there any cases that you know of that you're relying on for the proposition that when the district court is never asked to exercise Rule 403 discretion, that there's plain error review? Now, I would suppose that you could say this is plain error in the sense that had the district court been asked and had the district court said, no, I'm going to allow it in, that that would have been an abuse of discretion, and plainly so.
That's right, Your Honor.
So is that your argument?
Well, our argument is yes, that if the district court had been asked to, had that there had been an objection, it would have been abuse of discretion for the district court to let it in. I see my time has run, but I would just argue that in addition to the 403 argument, we do still object to the evidence under Miranda v. Arizona. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Kolar.
May it please the Court, Josh Kohler on behalf of the United States of America. Your Honor, on December 7, 2006, the jury convicted the defendant of bank robbery and brandishing a firearm in furtherance in connection with a crime of violence. That came after a three-day trial in which the jury saw the defendant rob a bank through high-quality video surveillance.
Mr. Kohler,
He saw it through high-quality video. He didn't rob the bank by high-quality video.
Blasted on top of their head. The video is in the record. That's my question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
The surveillance video at this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
the jury looked at this video and I gather the robbers had something obscuring at least part of their face, and the jury was nonetheless able to identify one of the robbers as being Mr. LaShore.
Yes, Your Honor. The robbers had a very small white cloth that partially covered their face. However, it left their entire eye line and their hair and their ears visible. And the jury was able to look at Mr. LaShore. Actually, Mr. LaShore was brought in front of the jury at the government's request so that the jury itself could make an identification of Mr. LaShore and compare Mr. LaShore's facial features to those facial features that clearly showed up on the video surveillance.
But none of the tellers were able to identify him. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The defendant makes his case out to be one that is of weak identification. It's, in fact, a case of very strong identification because although the defendant did not rob the bank through video surveillance, as Your Honor accurately pointed out, video surveillance captured the robbery. And the jury, over 3 days,
Video surveillance captured a picture of the robber. The police captured the robber.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You're familiar with the picture of a pipe that is entitled, "This is not a pipe."
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
But the jury was able to make an identification based on that videotaped surveillance of the bank robbery. In addition to that, the jury heard the testimony of an individual who saw the defendant counting dye-stained money on the day of the bank robbery. They heard testimony that established that the DNA found on the mask used at the bank robbery statistically excluded every person on earth other than the defendant. Now, the defendant raises a 403 objection, claiming that the videotaped post-arrest statement was whatever probative value it had was substantially outweighed by the danger that the jury would somehow inappropriately convict the defendant based on the fact that he was questioned by law enforcement. While the defense downplays the probative value of the videotape, there are, in fact, things in that videotape that linked the defendant to the crime and were not available elsewhere. First and foremost, the defendant in that videotape post-arrest statement said that the van that was used, the getaway van used in the bank robbery, belonged to his fiancée and was in his fiancée's possession the night before the bank robbery. That's important because that van has its ignition key completely removed. It can be started by anyone. And without that evidence, the defense would have been free to stand up and argue that the van was stolen that day or days before.
That's what it means by everybody talking about the steering column being punched up and trying to visualize.
And essentially that means that anyone that can open the door can take the car, can take the van.
Mm-hmm.
So the defendant establishing in the videotaped post-arrest statement that that van was in his fiancée's possession the night before is extremely probative. In addition, the fact that the defendant had clothes on that matched those that the jury was able to watch in the video surveillance of the bank robbery.
But these are pretty generic clothes, just khaki pants and a white t-shirt.
They were fairly generic clothes, but the way the defendant was wearing them, the way the cuff fell over the shoes, were almost identical. And in addition to that, the fact that the clothes themselves had red dye stain that the jury was explained came from the dye bag.
Theory that he just found this large bag of money on a back porch and started jamming money into his pocket.
And additionally, Your Honor, his demeanor while he was making that false exculpatory that on its face sounds incredulous and in fact is incredulous, his demeanor as he was making that was something that was important for the jury to see. Turning to the bait list, Your Honor, the defendant claims that the district court's admission of a list of the serial numbers of the bait money that was stolen from the bank was error. This was properly admitted. It was properly admitted under the business record exception under 8036. The head teller of the bank testified that this was something that was produced in the regular course of business and was systematically checked. She testified that every teller window had a bait list and that she systematically checked each bait list 2 to 3 times a year. Your Honor pointed to the systematic checking. That's something that is in the advisory committee notes as one of the bases for the business record exception. I would also note that there is no difference between this teller checking this and completely making the list anew.
Yeah, I think that's the only issue here. He's disputed. He understands that the list is regularly produced as part of but the question is the recording of the serial numbers a regular business activity? And if you look literally at the word recording, then checking something that's already been recorded doesn't sound like recording.
I think it's part of it is regularly recorded for two reasons, Your Honor. One, regularly recorded doesn't mean it has to happen every day. This happens every time a bank opens. There's testimony in the record that supports that there are multiple branches for this bank, and each teller window would have its own bait pack and corresponding bait list. In addition, if the head teller had merely Xeroxed the bait list and signed it, that would add nothing to the reliability of the document. Here you have something that is regularly recorded in the sense that it is part of the regular activities of the bank, and it does occur more often than once or twice. It happens every time a bank opens, every time a new teller window opens, not for the day, but for the first time, you know, it's put into commission. It happens every time there is a bank robbery, and it happens at multiple banks across this company.
I thought Ms. Bomar testified that she reviews these lists 3 times a year.
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether a new window has opened or a
yes, Your Honor. I was merely stating. I think it's a fair inference from the record when because of various addresses that Ms. Bomar was cross-examined on, it was established that there were multiple branches. Multiple branches, multiple teller windows, even if this is something that is only initially produced when a teller window was first put into commission, there is still a regular occurrence. In addition, and although the government feels strongly that the district court did not err in any way in allowing this evidence in, the district court did not say it didn't misquote the rules of evidence. It was concerned with bringing the fact that the bait list was produced on one day, and it wanted to know that it was checked before the date in question. So I think the district court was just being careful there. It wasn't necessarily misapplying the rules of evidence. Additionally, while it was properly admitted, this list established nothing that was contested. As the defendant points out in his brief, it merely established that $35 of the dye-stained money, $35 of the $1,700 recovered on the defendant, came from the bank. That was not in dispute. It was not in dispute under the defendant's own story, under the theory of the case and the post-arrest statement. The The government feels, and it will rest on its brief, but under any standard of review, there is no merit to the defendant's claims, and they certainly none of them can be said to have influenced the outcome of the jury's decision. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Kollar. Mr. Sullivan, I consumed your last minute, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make 2 points in response to what the government said. The first is that even though the jury was shown at the surveillance video, no one at the scene of the crime ever identified Mr. LaShore as the bank robber or identified any of the items that was found with his DNA on it. And we don't know whether the jury identified for purposes of its verdict Mr. LaShore based on the surveillance video or based on the last thing that it saw before it deliberated, namely a DVD that established the connection between Mr. LaShore and the crime on an improper basis. And on the point of the probative value of the DVD, almost every bit of content that the government sought to bring out about the interview, it did bring out by its examination of Special Agent Lauren, the interrogator. And the government's brief even admits that the video was largely inaudible. That suggests strongly that it was the image itself, not the content of the interview, that the government was trying to get at. Thank you.
Thank you very much.